The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported by the Sympathizer podcast from HBO. From executive producers Park Chan-wook and Robert Downey Jr., The Sympathizer is the new HBO original limited series based on the Pulitzer Prize-winning novel of the same name. On The Sympathizer podcast, join host Philip Nguyen in conversation with the cast, crew, and author Viet Thanh Nguyen as they discuss the making of this historic series. Stream new episodes of HBO's The Sympathizer, Sundays exclusively on Max, and listen to The Sympathizer podcast wherever you listen to podcasts.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive. Are you driving your car or doing laundry right now? Podcasts go best when they're bundled with another activity. Like Progressive home and auto policies, they're best when they're bundled too. Having these two policies together makes insurance easier and could help you save. Customers who save by switching their home and car insurance to Progressive save nearly $800 on average. Quote a home and car bundle today at Progressive.com. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $793 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2021 and May 2022. Potential savings will vary.
Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
No Attorney General of the United States has ever had what you'd call an easy job. But Merrick Garland's brief is maybe something else. Donald Trump tried his hardest to make the Justice Department into his personal legal team. So Garland now has to reestablish independence at the agency, but he can't exactly avoid politics. He has to decide, for example, how to prosecute the January 6 rioters who tried to overturn the election results. He also has to figure out how prosecutors should handle Trump officials who may have broken the law. He can hardly avoid the current legal battle over abortion that's engulfed the country. Merrick Garland spoke with The New Yorker's Jane Mayer last week as part of the New Yorker Festival.
So you've been in this job now for more than 6 months after having spent 25 years at your previous job. How do you like it? And how does it compare?
Well, you're right. I seem to spend a long time in my jobs. I think we can be assured I will not be spending 25 years in this one. One of the things I gave up was life tenure. I loved being a judge. I really did. But I love this job as well. There are definitely differences. Some of the advantages of this job are I no longer am barred from issuing advisory opinions, which I could not do as a judge, and now I could do 6 advisory opinions before breakfast. Nobody stops me. The other thing, and quite important, is that in the previous job, I had to wait until an important case or even an interesting case came before me. And now if I read something in the New Yorker online in the morning and it strikes me as the government's doing something wrong or the country's doing something wrong, somebody should be protected, I can do something about it. And sometimes by the end of the day. So those are good things. There are some disadvantages, like that I'm on the wrong side of lawsuits, the wrong side of the V, my name. I miss my judicial immunity.
But so you're being sued, like, basically every day.
I get sued quite a lot, yeah. But in the end, judges and attorneys general have the same bottom line requirement. We're obligated to uphold the rule of law and to be sure that equal justice under law is done. So in those ways, the jobs are very similar.
Well, listening to you talk about how you miss immunity brings up the something we would all like. But it is actually something that the former president said that he had while he was in office. One of the first questions I had for you was because the Twitterverse is very much alive with people who are on fire about the need to go after the former president and hold him accountable for things that he did in office when he was in office, now that he's out. And it's not just the Twitterverse. There are a number of critics, and even your former law professor, Lawrence Tribe, wrote a column, and he said that he thought that Trump should be prosecuted for his role in setting off the insurrection, and that he should be prosecuted for inciting insurrection and seditious conspiracy. Now, I know that you can't really talk about cases that are ongoing, but it did make me wonder whether you worry that by going after the foot soldiers and not the commander in chief, there may be a kind of a dangerous message being sent that there's no accountability in high places, and that others may, you know, sort of try to copy what happened before on January 6th. So how do you see that issue?
Well, like I've said many times before, January 6th was a heinous event, which almost interfered with the cornerstone of our democracy, which is the peaceful transfer of power from one administration to another. We have taken actions commensurate with how important this act was. So we have every U.S. attorney's office in the country. We have every FBI office, I think, except maybe Puerto Rico, has been involved in investigating this and making arrests. We've brought in U.S. attorneys from all over the country to be detailed to the U.S. attorney's office in Washington, which is the center of our investigation. We've already charged more than 600 people. We've gotten terabytes of information from citizen sleuths all over the country who've noticed someone that they recognize or been able to match with other pictures. We are doing everything we can to ensure that the perpetrators of January 6th are brought to justice. My very first thing that I did when I came to the Justice Department, very first day, was to go to the U.S. Attorney's Office in D.C. to discuss where the investigation is and where it's going. Every single week, I get briefed by the FBI director, the Deputy Attorney General, as to where this investigation is going. We will follow the facts and the law wherever they lead. I'm not, as you're quite right, I'm not able to talk about any particular individuals or particular investigations. There's a longstanding policy of the Justice Department. It's an element of the rule of law. It's very good reason why we follow that policy.
Well, what would you, if there's criticism that too many of the kind of the foot soldiers are being prosecuted, and maybe there's actually also been some criticism even from a couple judges that the charges being brought against them are misdemeanors and maybe not as serious as they could be. What would you say to people who are making those criticisms?
The prosecutors involved in this case are making determinations in every case about what charge fits the offense, what charge fits the law. I am quite aware that there are people who are criticizing us for not prosecuting sufficiently, and others who are complaining that we are prosecuting too harshly. This is, part of the territory for any prosecutor in any case. I have great confidence in the prosecutors who are doing these cases. They are committed to pursuing them until they find an answer and to making sure that the prosecution's charges and ultimate sentences fit the offenses.
I wanted to ask you about another subject that I know that has been really important to you, which is voting rights, vote and elections. Mm-hmm. You've made, a very impassioned speech about the importance of voting rights and shown that you want to make this a priority to defend them. But yet the Supreme Court's been cutting off, it seems like, every avenue to enforce the Voting Rights Act. So I wondered, what really can the Justice Department do to ensure voting rights, to fight voter suppression, and to also fight election subversion, which is what people are beginning to talk about more as a threat moving forward?
Yeah. So I do feel deeply impassioned about this. This was the purpose of the Justice Department, founded during Reconstruction by President Grant for the purpose of protecting the right to vote of African Americans in the South during Reconstruction. The Voting Rights Act in 1965 was maybe the most important piece of legislation to ensure that there would not be discrimination in procedures and practices involving voting. That act gave the Justice Department powers, particularly Section 5, which required pre-clearance of changes in covered jurisdictions of practices and procedures. Now, you are right that in the Shelby County case, the Supreme Court effectively eliminated Section 5, throwing us back to where we were before the Voting Rights Act with respect to the requirement to go after individual cases. We're left with Section 2 questions, which also prohibit violations, discriminatory procedures in that regard. Then in the Brnovich case, the Supreme Court again narrowed what right. we have under Section 2. So the premise of your question, which is, are our tools weakened? Yes, they are. But our passion hasn't weakened. The Voting Rights Section and the Civil Rights Division as a whole, it was greatly depleted previously when I got here. So the very first, one of the first things we did was insist upon doubling the size of the voting section, and we have. We will and have used Section 2 to bring actions. This is what we did in Georgia. We are seriously and urgently investigating and examining other changes in procedures and practices, and particularly looking at all the redistricting that's done as a consequence of the decennial census. But again, I think we need Congress to help here. We need a change. We need a legislation to give us back authorities that we need in order to do this.
Into another hot topic of the topic of abortion. The Justice Department weighed in on the Texas state law, SB 8. It was clearly crafted with the intention of avoiding judicial review, and yet you jumped in, and I'm just curious, how did you see that issue, and why do you think it was important for the DOJ to get in there?
Well, I think we saw it in the way the premise of your question put it. You know, our job at the Justice Department is to protect the Constitution and to protect the constitutional rights of Americans. They've deputized any person in the United States, whether they're in Texas or not, whether they have any relationship with the woman or not, whether they have any injury or other connection or not, to bring a case when that Texas law is violated or is attempted to be violated, and receive at least $10,000 in bounty. This is not only obviously intended, but expressly intended to prevent judicial review of an unconstitutional statute. And because clinics are not willing to risk or unable to risk the financial costs that will occur if they go forward, they have stopped providing services. So women are both unable to provide, get services and unable to get judicial review of an unconstitutional statute at the time they need the services. Every American should be worried about this, regardless of your party and regardless of your politics, because this can easily be a model for any constitutional right, not just the right we're talking about. It can be pursued by any state and not just Texas. And it doesn't take long to think about what the consequences for American democracy are if states start deputizing private bounty hunters to prevent citizens from exercising their constitutional rights. So when the Supreme Court declined to stop the case and the private case was brought, we felt it was our obligation to jump in immediately afterwards. It was a week afterwards, and to bring our own case.
Are you fairly confident you'll win on this?
We are confident. We brought a case that is well established in the law. We brought the case directly against Texas and against its officers, including judges, and including against anyone who is purporting to be deputized on behalf of the state. And we believe that is well-founded in the law.
There is another area that I think that I gather is something that you care a lot about, and that is the antitrust area. And I wanted to ask you about that. I read that antitrust was your favorite subject in law school. It sounds very dry, but I guess I'd love to know why. And I think what many people want to know is, I mean, at this point, there's sort of a growing feeling of concern, worry about the power of the big tech companies in this country, and people are trying to figure out what to do about that. And I wonder if specifically if you see the big tech sector is in your sights or in the sights of the antitrust division, basically.
Well, you're right. I have said it was my first love in law school. I think this is because I had a great industrial organization economics professor in my last year in college, and because I worked for some really great antitrust giants, both in my legal practice in the Justice Department and in law school. When I came in, just as was the case in the Civil Rights Division, the Antitrust Division was seriously depleted in terms of resources and personnel. So the first thing we did, and is in our request to the Congress for the FY22 budget, is to greatly increase the budget. And particularly with respect to personnel, we hope to increase the division by 90 personnel. We are
You're adding 90 people to that
people,
to the Antitrust Division?
If we get the money from the Congress, yes. Let me be clear.
Are they
about
likely
that.
To support that?
Yes, I think so.
I think
they're, you know, I spoke at a budget hearing. I was attacked for many things, but not for the suggestion. For that suggestion.
Well, it's fine, but there's bipartisan support to some extent for some of this, isn't there?
I think there is. Uh-huh. And, you know, we've been off to a really strong start. We still, you know, you asked about big tech. We have our the Google case, which was begun in the previous administration. It's being aggressively followed in this administration. We've been working on stopping mergers that would foreclose competition. We succeeded in stopping a merger of two of the three largest insurance brokerages. We just filed against what I call a quasi-merger between American Airlines and JetBlue. We've brought both civil and criminal cases in efforts of companies to foreclose wage competition and allocate markets with respect to the labor market. We have ongoing matters involving everything from agriculture to banking to real estate. So the Antitrust Division is energized and eager to go forward, and we do think that ensuring fair competition is an essential element of our obligation to ensure that justice is done.
Thank you, Mr. Attorney General, so
Pleasure.
Much for giving us your time.
Great to be with you. Thanks.
Attorney General Merrick Garland speaking with staff writer Jane Mayer at the New Yorker Festival last week. Now, an important update. After they spoke, after the interview, a federal judge issued a ruling that temporarily blocks the Texas abortion law, and that's in response to the suit brought by the Department of Justice. Garland called that a victory for women in Texas and for the rule of law. The state of Texas has appealed. You can find out more about the New Yorker Festival at newyorker.com/festival.
At Radiolab, we love nothing more than nerding out about science, neuroscience, chemistry.
But we do also like to get into other kinds of stories. Stories about policing or
politics,
country music,
hockey,
sex of bugs.
Regardless of whether we're looking at science or not science, we bring a rigorous curiosity to get you the answers.
And hopefully make you see the world anew.
Radiolab, adventures on the edge of what we think we know.
Wherever you get your podcasts.